And Robert Zink is joining us on the phone. He's written a new book. It's called The 3-Minute Outdoorsman. It distills the latest news from the world of science into 3-minute tidbits of interesting information for the regular reader. He is the Breckenridge Chair in Ornithology at the Bell Museum of Natural History at the University of Minnesota. Joining us by phone now, Robert Zink. Is it all right if I call you Bob?
Oh, that'd be great. Please do.
Hey, thanks, Bob. I thought you'd be that kind of guy. This is a fascinating book, really a joy to read. How'd you come about with this idea? Describe the process.
Sure. Happy to, Dave. As you said, in my day job, I'm a professor, and I do, you know, research, and I, you know, publish scientific papers. But when I'm not at my day job, I do a lot of hunting. I'm an avid bow hunter. I'm a turkey hunter. I'm a grouse hunter. I'm a duck hunter. I'm a goose hunter. And I also fish. And so away from my day job, I meet lots of really great people who you know, are interested in the sorts of things that I learned from reading the scientific literature, but don't have the language to read these same papers. So I started writing these articles, these short articles that kind of abstract an interesting scientific paper and make it accessible to people who are just as smart as me, but they don't speak the same language sometimes.
Yeah, it's a real review of the research on this field of wildlife and birds and everything outdoors, and you've really done a wonderful job of putting together some fascinating stories. Who is your primary audience for this book? Would you describe your potential reader?
Oh, boy, my potential reader would be interested in, or would be curious when they go outside, when they see deer, when they wonder what's in the water under their boat, when they wonder why birds choose the birds they do for mates. You know, it's just kind of all over the place. And if I could give you an example of the first thing I did, it might kind of give you some insight into how I got started.
Yes, please.
So I read a paper in a scientific journal about the Labrador duck, which is an extinct duck that was on the East Coast. And we don't have very many specimens of it in museum collections. And there were only 7 eggshells or egg samples known of this entire species. And so some people I knew put some chemical solutions in these eggs, sloshed them around, and analyzed the DNA in the eggshells, because there's some hangs on the membrane on the inside of the shell, compared it to DNA from real specimens. And what they found is that all 7 of the known eggs of the Labrador duck were actually mallards. And so I actually thought this was kind of funny, and so I wrote a paper entitled What Little We Knew About the Labrador Duck Just Got Littler, and I sent it into Outdoor News. I don't know if you see that fine newspaper up the shore, but the editor said, I know you won't be interested in this, and it's, you know, it's kind of esoteric, and he wrote back and said, may he please publish this. And I thought, you know, 150 scientific articles in, and no editor has ever asked me that before. And so I thought, maybe this was kind of fun. I had fun writing it. I learned something, and people seemed to enjoy reading it. So I started writing about topics of all sorts of things that came across my desk that I thought would be of interest to people that go outdoors and hunt and fish or hike or birdwatch or just watch nature.
Right. Now, there's so much that you cover in these wonderful, over 240 pages, but you break it down into nice little segments. 3-Minute Outdoorsman is the name of the book, and so it's sort of designed to be picked up and read a little and then set back down. How do you go about choosing the various topics? How do you take everything that's out there and hone them down into what you present?
Well, most of the things, or a lot of things that I write about are papers that I'll have read that I just kind of go, oh my goodness, you got to be kidding me. I had no idea. So there's something that I learned something about, but it could be about fish, it could be about zebras, it could be about hunting deer, it could be about chickadees. It's just whatever I think would be of interest that people might not otherwise hear about.
Yeah, now it's amazing that some of this stuff is funded, and I know, you know, several studies the reproduction of ducks in particular, there's been some criticism for public funding going towards some of the studies.
Yeah.
Could you touch on some of that a bit?
Well, many of my articles have appeared in Outdoor News, and that was the only one they wouldn't publish because it used the word, for the male organ too many times. And It turns out that as a duck, as an avid duck hunter, and as an ornithologist for 30 years, I did not know that during the breeding season, male ducks actually have a penis that's corkscrew shaped, and it might be as long as their entire body. And the female has a similar reproductive tract that's kind of in reverse. And so the idea is that if you've ever watched mallards in the spring, mallards are a good example, there'll be several males chasing a female, and they're intent on one thing, and that's mating with her, and she's intent on one thing, and that's escaping. And oftentimes three or four drakes that are chasing a hen mallard are just too much, and they'll force her down, and they try and mate with her. But if she doesn't want to be mated by those males, because they're not usually her mate, all she has to do is sort of put her body at a certain angle, and the two male and female reproductive tracts don't fit together. So it's this kind of long-term coevolutionary story about how female ducks protect themselves from basically what you would call rape.
Yeah, it's completely fascinating. But I think it's, you know, you've heard of the birds and the bees.
Yeah, well, let's turn to how smart your chickadees are.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me about some of your favorite topics.
So, if you know, you wake up in the winter up there in Grand Marais, and you look out at your feeder. Do you feed birds?
I do.
And so, what are the birds you have at your feeder?
Lots of chickadees.
Lots of black-capped chickadees, and sometimes some boreals, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, before we started feeding birds, the black-capped chickadees still had to survive the winter in Minnesota. And when you sit and watch them, you don't realize that they come to your feeder and they go away and they come and they go, and it's like nonstop the whole short day period, right?
Yeah, feeding frenzy.
Feeding frenzy. And so it turns out that what a lot of the chickadees do when they're doing this is they're going off and they're taking a seed from your bird feeder and they're caching it somewhere. They're storing it somewhere. And so they can eat it when you forget to fill your bird feeder or when it's really cold and they don't have enough to eat. But like me, if you can't remember where you put something, then it's not going to do you any good. You could store as many seeds as you wanted, but if you couldn't find them again later, it's not going to help. And so this guy at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas actually came to my house in the northeast part of the Twin Cities Metro, and he collected some of our chickadees, and his idea was that chickadees that live in really, really severe winters like yours, in order to survive, have to store more seeds than chickadees in less severe winter climates. And in order to remember where they do this, they have to have bigger brains. And so, just like your women are strong and your men are good looking and your children are above average, your chickadees are smarter too.
Ah, what a claim to fame.
Our chickadees have bigger brains because if they don't, they can't remember where they put the seeds that are going to make them help them survive the winter.
That's Minnesota for you.
Yeah, really.
What's something like completely shocking and surprising you learned from your research? What's your most surprising story?
Most surprising story? Oh, that's a good one. Okay, well, it has to be this. In one of the most prestigious journals in all of science, it's called the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in the U.S., PNAS, this paper appeared where this group from the Czech Republic claimed that for centuries, sheep herders, farmers, wildlife observers, hunters, had not noticed that large ungulate animals like cows and deer, when they're not stressed, orient to the magnetic north. And I thought, well, that can't be. How do they get this information? And so I read further in their paper, and it turns out they got their information by looking at images from Google Earth. And then I said, okay, I don't believe this at all. Wrote to the authors and said, send me your coordinates. And so they did. And in a few seconds, I was on Google Earth looking at a field of a pasture outside of Buenos Aires, Argentina. And there are all these cows standing there. And if you kind of drew lines through their long axis, you know, from tail to head, they're facing magnetic north. And I thought, okay, so one example does not, you know, a story make. But it turns out that all over the world, different times of the year, different winds, different times of the day, different temperatures, if the animals are not stressed, and so, you know, if the cows are heading for the barn, it's time to get milked or fed, they're going to go whichever direction the barn is, and all bets are off. But during other times, they orient magnetic north. And I said, well, okay, so that's interesting, but deer, you can't possibly know this is true for deer. And what they did was they went out and they found beds of deer in northern Europe of things like roe deer, a different species than we have. And, you know, have you come across a deer bed in the winter?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, so you can see where the deer's been laying, and if you draw a line through the long axis of that bed, you can then get your compass out and figure out which direction it is, and it turns out it's also magnetic north. And so the idea apparently is that if you're an animal like a deer, that at least when you're herded up, provides you safety because there's more eyes, there's, you know, greater ability to fend off predators. If you get scattered for some reason during the day, if you all went in random directions, it'd be hard to reform the herd. But if you all went magnetic north, because you have this little compass in your head, then you could reform the herd a lot faster. So they claim that for centuries, no one's noticed this, and they were right.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite stories too, Bob. That's funny. And I don't know what's more scary, that these animals have this ability or that we can go online and observe this from satellites in space.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing. I was very skeptical, but after looking at the information, it's like, you know, maybe the explanation is wrong. Maybe there's some other reason, but they're facing magnetic north.
Amazing.
Oh, yeah, figure that out.
And on the phone with us is Bob Zink. He's written an incredible new book, The 3-Minute Outdoorsman. I know it's been critically acclaimed. Ron Shera, Babe Winkleman, all the legends have read this and love it. And if you have any interest in the outdoor world and natural world, it's a must read, The 3-Minute Outdoorsman. Bob, have you got a little excerpt you'd like to share with us from all your chapters?
Well, most of the times when I've read to people in the past, it was to my kids, and the point was to put them to sleep.
Mm. Yeah.
And so I'd rather talk about a new paper that hasn't come out yet, because it's counterintuitive, and I think it's fascinating, and it's about zebras.
By all means.
So let me ask you this. Why do zebras have stripes?
Mm. Buck thinks it's to confuse the predators.
Okay, I like that one.
To tell them apart from cows?
Well... let me tell you this. It turns out that no two zebras look alike, okay? So their stripes are all slightly different, so they could potentially tell each other apart.
Okay.
Remember when we were, we used to ask when we were kids, are zebras white animals with black stripes or black animals with white stripes? Well, if you live in that part of Africa where they do and you're a black animal, you're going to get overheated, right?
Right.
So maybe painting white stripes on your body is a way to provide some cooling. Another possibility is confusing predators. Like if there's a bunch of zebras in a herd and they're moving about, it's hard to figure out which one is a zebra and which one is part of the herd or just the herd. And I would have bet money on all of those, but the answer turns out to be biting flies.
Biting flies? Tell me more.
That's what I said. I'm going, oh, come on. I was betting on the white stripes cooling the animal. So... it turns out that if you're a biting fly, like a horse fly or a stable fly...
Oh, I hate those.
Yeah, they hurt like crap, huh?
Yeah.
They will land on an all-black surface. They'll land on an all-white surface. But when they're confronted with a black and white striped surface, they either don't recognize it as a place to land or they perceive it as... it confuses them. So, like, sometimes if I just walk up from a nap and I'm going down the stairs and I got my bifocals on, I'm having a little trouble seeing where the steps are. Apparently, that confuses these flies, and if you do the experiments in nature and you make the stripes, the black and white stripes, the same width as on the zebra, it maximally confuses these flies,
wow,
which can draw up to 2 cups of blood a day from something like a zebra.
Wow.
So I was with you and your producer, or whoever talked up in the back, sorry I didn't get your name, that it was to confuse predators and so forth, but it turns out that lions eat disproportionately large numbers of zebras where they're there. So the stripes don't have anything to do with protecting the zebras from getting eaten by lions.
Yeah, but
in fact, it may work to their disadvantage. They may be striped to avoid getting eaten by flies, but it makes it easier for lions to catch them.
Well, you know, there's a real genius patent here for some new form of camouflage outdoor wear, perhaps.
You know, that's what everybody I've talked to has said. Like, the big question is, does it work against black flies?
Yes.
Because if it did, I mean, wow, imagine that. There were people that died building the Alaska Highway from black fly blights.
Oh, I hate those.
Black fly blights. Yeah, they're nasty.
Yeah, it's crazy. Truth is stranger than fiction, especially in the natural world.
True.
And you've summed it up in so many chapters. Where's the best place to keep this book now? You touched on it in your preface.
Well, I can't say that. I mean, it's not politically correct to say you should keep it in your bathroom.
Well, a lot of folks up here have outhouses, though. Equally
well,
attractive
then there,
for the outhouse.
It can serve a double purpose after you finish a chapter.
Yeah, well, it's a 3-minute outdoorsman. It's so readable by anybody who's outdoors, and we've got a lot of them up here, so I think this is going to be a real success for you, Bob.
Well, I hope you'll enjoy it.
I have thoroughly, and thank you so much for joining us here on the Roadhouse.
Loved
Anything
it.
You'd like to add?
No, I just hope that, spring hurries up and comes along, and is the ice off your lakes up there?
Not quite.
Not quite,
not
yeah.
Not just yet.
We have a place on Winnie, and we're not going up this week because the ice isn't off, and I'm looking forward to coming up and joining you.
Well, the ice is finally off of Lake Superior that, you know, you could always get out on the big lake.
Not with my boat.
Well, we hope to see you this summer, Bob, and thanks for joining us on the Roadhouse.
Thanks, Dave, for calling.